Hi, this is Faith Mitchell, President of Grantmakers in Health. I'd like to welcome you to the latest edition in GIH's podcast series. Our goal is to provide you with an insider's view of what's happening on the front lines of health by hearing from leaders in the field. I hope you enjoy these podcasts and find them insightful as you lead your philanthropic work.
On behalf of Grantmakers in Health, I'd like to welcome you to the 5th annual Lauren LeRoy Health Policy Lecture. My name is Ryan Barker. I'm the Vice President of Health Policy with the Missouri Foundation for Health. Grantmakers in Health established the Lauren LeRoy Health Policy Lecture Series in honor of its former president and CEO, Lauren LeRoy, and her commitment to increasing communication between the worlds of philanthropy and policy. This series is supported by grants from the Blue Shield of California Foundation, the California Endowment, California Healthcare Foundation, California Wellness Foundation, Colorado Health, Kaiser Permanente, Missouri Foundation for Health, New York State Health Foundation, and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. This year's lecture features Reverend Starsky Wilson, who is president and CEO of the Deaconess Foundation in St. Louis. They are a faith-based grant-making organization devoted to making child well-being a civic priority in the St. Louis region. Reverend Wilson became president of the foundation in 2011. He is also, through the end of this month, pastor of the St. John's Church, also known as the Beloved Community, and chair of the National Committee for Responsive Philanthropy. In 2014, he was appointed by Missouri Governor Jay Nixon to co-lead the Ferguson Commission, which was a group of citizens empowered to study the underlying conditions and make policy recommendations to help the region progress through issues exposed by the death of Michael Brown Jr. If you have not looked at or read the Ferguson Commission report, which is called Forward Through Ferguson, I would highly encourage it. It is a big set of policy recommendations. It just shows the incredible work of the commission and that I think are relevant to communities throughout the country. Reverend Wilson has championed efforts to support advocacy and organizing, promoting healing-based justice, and deepen investment in racial equity. Just on a more personal note, I will say Starsky is a hero to myself, an inspiration to many of us throughout the country and in the St. Louis region. He is a great example for those in philanthropy of not just talking the talk, but walking the walk. He is out there with the young people, participating in actions, participating in protests. He's a disruptor, an innovator, and a good friend. So please join me in welcoming Reverend Wilson to the podium.
Good afternoon. I'm really glad to be here, like really glad to be here. There was lots of snow in St. Louis last night. There was lots of snow in St. Louis this morning. There was lots of snow on my plane. And so I am really, really glad to be here. I'm really pleased at the opportunity to share. Thank you, Ryan, for your gracious and generous introduction. Thank you, Faith, for the opportunity to share with this august body. And thank you all for being a part of this conversation. So I'm a preacher. I go places, and a lot of times they ask me to give keynotes. And so on the plane, I tell myself, it's a keynote. Don't preach. It's a keynote. It's a keynote. And so those are usually the things I do. Keynotes, and then I'll preach. So I give a sermon. But then you said a lecture. So I had to Google it. I didn't know what that was. I asked Faith. I said, could you send me, like, are there images of this thing from the past? And so I saw leaders of the Hewlett Foundation. I saw Manuel Pastor from years past. And I got really nervous because he was with us in St. Louis last month. And I was like, he really knows how to do this thing called a lecture. And so I don't know that I'm going to do it right. But just hang with a brother for a second. And if not, get another cup of soup and we'll see how this works out. And I'll try to recoup in the question and answer. There are two things that I want to do. Number one, whenever possible, I try to conjure the spirit of the ancestors who created the space for me. And so I bring those into rooms with little pens and the like for me to ground me. The other is when I come to talk about things related to Ferguson, particularly the Ferguson Uprising and the commission's work, I like to bring the voices and images of young people who I believe were providing remarkable leadership prior to the commission coming together. And so on the screen, I'd like to introduce you to some people and introduce you to our experience in St. Louis, primarily in 2014 and 2015. But that experience, much like the experience in America, is conflicted with different realities. And so there are images that may, for some, be triggering. So before I started those images, I wanted to let you know that they were. And so find the best looking person at your table, such that there's something that you don't like on the screen, you look at them. These images depict much of our story in St. Louis in 2014 and 15, and I'll begin to share them at this time. Every city has a soul. Oh yeah, by the way, I saw with a lecture, you're supposed to keep your feet in the same place. So you know me. Every city has a soul, a unique personality, an ethical identity, an animating spirit. In the language of some faith traditions, including my own, the soul is alternatively known and spoken of as the heart or the seat of one's will. Matters of the heart and soul for the people of St. Louis captured the world's imagination in 2014 and 2015. St. Louis celebrates as its founding February 14th, 1764, when Pierre Laclede and Auguste Choteau established the settlement of St. Louis. So in 2014, it was our 250th birthday. And a group of people gathered together on a steering committee called SDL 250 had to think about what we were going to do for our birthday. And on your birthday, you can do really cool stuff. You can have fun, you can have parties, and you can enter into times of deep reflection. If you're a deep person like Retta, then you go reflect somewhere. And so we decided we didn't want to do all that deep reflecting kind of stuff. We had had a significant anniversary in 2004, the centennial of the 1904 World's Fair. And so we did a lot of citywide planning on that. So we decided this time we just wanted to have a party. And so we did. We had a party on February 14th, because that's our birthday, Valentine's Day, in the crown jewel of St. Louis, Forest Park. We had a burning love party. Burning love, because it was Valentine's Day, and we needed an excuse to have a bonfire, because it was cold, right? And so we had a burning love party there in Forest Park in our city, and a virtual bakery of commissioned birthday cake statues were littered across the local landscape. This was the thing that my wife took my family to do, was to find all of these birthday cakes. There are pictures of my children under duress beside birthday cakes. There was a birthday cake at City Hall, and there was a birthday cake under the arch, and there was a birthday cake, really importantly, at the location of the very first Emo's Pizza. If you've ever been to St. Louis, you understand. And so while the city began to celebrate, we recognized that this was a significant time, and we decided we would celebrate and marking these historical landmarks and cultural institutions in our community. And at the same time, a Deaconess Foundation in April of that year also decided to celebrate. The Evangelical Deaconess Society of St. Louis was established in 1889 for German immigrants who, by the way, were not appropriately treated in the city's health system because they did not speak the language. These immigrants were not cared for by city hospitals, so much so that the Deaconess Heritage and History tells of them having to self-administer their medicines because people would leave them in the hallway not wanting to come into contact with this marginalized group of Americans who were immigrants in the mid-1800s. And so they decided to reach into the resources of their own religious and cultural tradition to consecrate an order of women, deaconesses, who would commit their lives to nursing, teaching, and caring, to theological education, and to learning nursing so that they would care for one another in homes, not hospitals. They would live with those who were infirmed, and they would commit their whole lives to taking care of them. So the Evangelical Deaconess Society of St. Louis was established in 1889. So in 2014, we decided to have a party too. It was our 125th anniversary. But we were a little more distinguished, of course. We are engaged in philanthropy, of course. And so we decided we would also have symposia where we would reflect together on child well-being in the region and work to develop a forward-leaning definition of child well-being in a way that was not as reactive to the welfare and to the child protection conversation we were having. We rather wanted to have one about child flourishing. So we partnered with our friends at Brown School of Social Work at Washington University, and we began to launch that. So in February, we began our celebrations with a big burning love party. In April, we had this celebration at Deaconess Foundation and with our partners around child well-being. The year was off to a great start. We were successfully celebrating the best of our civic identity, the soul of our city. And in June, one of the defining characteristics of our self-image was acknowledged nationally when Charity Navigator named us the most charitable region in their annual Metropolitan Market Survey. With the United Way campaign outpacing our population size, a five-star Urban League affiliate leading its peers, with well-endowed institutions of higher learning like Washington University in St. Louis, philanthropy has always been a source of pride. Indeed, it was the philanthropy of a small group of St. Louisans that wrote us into the history books at a prior moment which captured the imagination of the world. In 1927, a young man by the name of Charles Lindbergh made the first solo nonstop transatlantic flight from Long Island, New York, to Paris, France. Originally from Detroit and later a resident of New Jersey and New England, his famous aircraft, which now greets visitors at the entry of the National Air and Space Museum here in DC, was named the Spirit of St. Louis. Why was it named the Spirit of St. Louis? Because we paid for it. It was named in honor of the benefactors who supported the actual plane. The charitable spirit of a few of her citizens carried the city into this moment, which sparked international interest in investment in pursuit of the wild blue yonder. If nothing else, the spirit of St. Louis is charitable. It is philanthropic. It is caring. This is why the killing of Michael Brown Jr. on August 9, 2014 in Ferguson, Missouri was so painful for many. The city of Ferguson only takes up 6 square miles and 20,000 people in a metropolitan area of 2.8 million. The actions, though, that day initiated a continuum of collective suffering and questioning that touched the hearts of every citizen, the very soul of the region. The image of this young black teenager expiring for 4 hours in the street while birthday cakes mark the important corners in our region. The idea that one call to public service took his life as we celebrate our commitment to public benefit. The fact that Mike had just finished high school when we take pride in the resources of our colleges and higher education institutions. The reality that our social programs could not save him as we prepared to launch the annual workplace campaigns for the United Way. This picture of his crying mother restrained by yellow tape at a crime scene just a few miles from Lindbergh Boulevard, named for that famed aviator. This is the stuff of soul trauma, an experience of mass moral injury. The very spirit of St. Louis came into question. Were we who we said we were, who we thought we were, who we believed we were? Do the actions of public servants say more about who we were than the checks we write? Are the choices of Officer Darren Wilson and the refusal of the county prosecutor Robert McCullough to pursue charges against him and a history of racial fragmentation through policymaking more reflective of the spirit of St. Louis, actually? Is the uprising of a youth-led, black-led, multiracial coalition calling for police reform a more appropriate acknowledgement of this anniversary than our birthday cakes? While the questions took different forms, the suffering was real for everybody. In late August of that year, because I'm trying to keep up with things that are going on, and because there ain't no Ferguson Commission yet, so I just got two jobs right then. I'm running errands and I pick up my three sons from school and I pick them up, have them in the back seat of the car, and I go to the cleaners and I got to pick up some clothes. But I'm trying to keep in touch with what's going on the ground. And so I turn on news radio and they're talking about these young people who are still in the streets, of course, 2 weeks later, who knew that they would stay in the streets for 300 days. And so as the radio is playing, my son, then 9 years old, Starsky the second, we weren't that creative about names yet, so the first one, just rattle off one that we knew, says, "Dad, every time I hear about Michael Brown, my stomach starts to hurt." Challenged by the statement, I gave him permission to leave any room where the discussion was happening and to remind me that I would need to monitor myself on this issue as well. Of course, his pain could have been the impact of the fear, the nerves of a young black boy wondering if this would ever happen to him. It could have been diagnosed as toxic stress. Toxic, by the way, has been named the word of the year by Oxford Dictionaries. Then again, as a child of two parents who are human service professionals, a young person raised in the church where volunteerism for community uplift is encouraged, and a pretty good student in a public magnet school where he learned a history of American exceptionalism, it seemed rather he was presenting the signs of our entire community's internal conflict. His stomach ache was a sign of guilt and grief because he thought we were better than this. And he was not alone. In November of that year, as has been noted, Missouri Governor Jeremiah A. Nixon asked me to co-chair the Ferguson Commission, this group of 16 citizens empowered to study the underlying issues exposed by Michael Brown's death and to make public policy recommendations that would help us to become a fairer, a stronger, and a more inclusive region. The commission held public meetings for more than a year, listening to citizen experts in life experience, academic credential, and policymaking. In four of the meetings, we polled the group about trauma and toxic stress. The folks in our meetings hurt like Lil Starsky. On average, 70% of attendees had experienced trauma and toxic stress. 72% also believed the community in which they lived suffered trauma. The traumatic potential of racism was also not lost on them. On average, 98% of respondents believed someone can be traumatized by racism, and 55% had themselves experienced trauma due to racism. Frankly, by the time we got to the real-time polling in those 2015 meetings, we knew what they would tell us. Tear-filled testimony about economic inequity from a young woman who worked a double shift at McDonald's in order to buy one pack of diapers for her child had already joined the witness of a high school senior who called for cultural competence in the classroom based upon a teacher who comforted him when he lost his mother, and he said at the podium that teacher saved his life. In both instances, I saw well-positioned business leaders charitably respond behind the scenes to these individual stories. Perhaps, though, these were simply insufficient efforts to assuage the internal trauma of coming face-to-face with the impact of their support for systems that produce results malaligned with their stated values. While many questions and concerns were addressed through the commission's meetings, the most critical was underlying and not explicitly stated. How might we actually become the people we've already been saying we were? It seemed to me if a nostalgic civic imagination with a few glaring gaps, civic imagination that forgets the 1917 East St. Louis race riots, civic imagination that forgets the Jefferson Bank protest, civic imagination that forgets 1968 all wholesale together. Sound familiar? If that was what may have gotten us here, then perhaps an inclusive, visionary process of collective imagining may well be the way out. Beyond the stated charge of Executive Order 1415, which established the Ferguson Commission, this was our real work. To steward a process cultivating civic imagination in response to the pain of communal soul trauma. Ultimately, the 3,000 people who worked through their own pain in this effort articulated a vision, a hope. If I was preaching, I'd say an eschatological hope. But I'm not preaching because my feet are still in the same spot. Hopefully, this pain and process can be instructive for others. But if it will be, first, we've got to check our work. Mama said, don't turn in your work unless you check it. In the process of learning on this journey, I was found by a few people who really helped me out. I came to know of the work of Dr. Sean Jenright and to meet him, Associate Professor of Education and African American Studies at San Francisco State University, the author of Hope and Healing in Urban Education, How Activists Are Reclaiming Matters of the Heart. Y'all know him? Okay, all right. I'll top level this stuff so we can do some questions and answers. Just for the record, the governor named every state agency he could and put them in that executive order. That was his way of saying, I have no idea what the hell I'm supposed to be doing right now. So he named education, and he named transportation, and he named economic empowerment, he named economic development. We had to figure out how to make sense of all of that stuff. We really just asked the community to prioritize it. He named every state agency there was, and then he threw in the stuff that we do with commissions. You know, stuff like family stability and community empowerment. You just threw the stuff in there. And so we had to figure out what to do with it. And so I was the co-chair, the managing director, who's one of the commissioners. Her name is Bethany Johnson Javois. Bethany is a board member of Missouri Foundation for Health. She's a board member for Deaconess Foundation. She's the CEO of the St. Louis Integrated Health Network, which is the collaborative of our FQHCs. And so you know what we did. It's 2014. We're people who work in the context of health and philanthropy. We dropped some collective impact language on that thing. Sprinkled in a little social determinants of health conversation. And then, of course, we coated that thing with trauma-informed error thing. True story, right? Because if indeed you are a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And so in the context of that moment in time, y'all think back. I know y'all have advanced far beyond it now, but in 2014, it was trauma-informed everything. It was collective impact was the answer to everything before we even applied a racial equity lens to that. And so that's what we did. And so we find in the context of those policy recommendations calls for trauma-informed care in schools, trauma-informed approaches to health in our community, trauma-informed this, trauma-informed that. And Dr. Jim Wright is helpful in helping us to evolve beyond that. So I'll just share a bit of his thinking, noting, of course, that trauma-informed care broadly refers to this set of principles, I quote him, that guide and direct how we view the impact of severe harm, he notes, on young people's mental, physical, and emotional health. Trauma-informed care encourages support and treatment to the whole person rather than a focus on treating individual symptoms or specific behaviors. And of course, this doesn't constitute health, he notes. Absence of disease doesn't constitute health, nor the absence of violence constitute peace. The reduction of pathology does not constitute well-being, hope, happiness, imagination, aspirations. He goes further, a healing-centered approach is holistic, involving culture, spirituality, civic action, and collective healing. A healing-centered approach views trauma not simply as an individual isolated experience, but rather highlights the ways in which trauma and healing are experienced collectively. He lays out these four elements, including the fact that it is explicitly political, not clinical. He notes that healing-centered approaches are culturally grounded. He notes that they are asset-driven and focused on well-being rather than symptoms we want to suppress. And he notes that healing-centered engagement supports providers in their own healing. I just want to check our work real fast. In our process, we sought to engage in a process that we knew was political. First subversion of the process, the answers could not be with the people who had the PhDs only. But I had to be deeply informed by the folks who had the experience of the harm and the hurt. And so our meetings, which we initially went out trying to be good, respectable commissioners, because you know how commissions are supposed to work. They're supposed to work like Congress or whatever work, right? So our first meeting, we got a big old table with black tablecloth because we good, respectable people. And then we have the pop-up nameplates that say Reverend this and Mr. that. Because there are a lot of people watching at that point. We got our first briefing from the Attorney General's office on Sunshine Law because we were, of course, a state bureaucracy that had been created. And so we had to make sure people understood that we felt that in order for people to trust us, we had to tell them all about our bios. So we started doing that. And as we began to tell them about our bios and how we're going to go about the process, like it was a board, like anything else, the kind of stuff we do at a board retreat. And then we do the stuff like we do at a congressional hearing. From the back, somebody said, it's time for us to talk. And as he held the room, a sister who was crying began to say, talk about her son. Let her tell her story. Began to talk about her son weeping coming to the mic. And we recognized, finally, this wasn't about us. It was about them. And so the political process that began with us, the process of riot commission politics that lets elected executives look like they're doing something when they're really not, the process that has been set up by people like Dr. Lindsay Lupo, who studied this riot commission politics process to say that it's really just to process people's emotions so that they forget and move on to something else. This process had to be more than about us. It had to be about people who are deeply affected, and it had to be given to them. It had to create for them a policy agenda. And ultimately, that's what we did. I didn't know we were doing this until Dr. Michael Sheradin from Washington University named and put a pin on it. I was there to give a talk about something or other. Preacher, I talk a lot. You may have noticed so far. He said, ultimately, what happened in the process, and this wasn't as much us as it was, I think, the spirit moving through us. I tell you, I'm a preacher. Our spirit's moving through us. That we were able to take a state bureaucracy and politicize it and make it an organizing tool. So that the policy agenda that was developed was not the one that we in philanthropy would have come up with. It didn't say health enough. So we didn't know what to do with it exactly. It required too much interpretation. It was too long, my mentors told me. 189 is too many calls to action. Can anybody focus on that? So we prioritized 47 of them. And then we set at the end a process with the organizing table, those who were organizing around Jobs with Justice, the Organization for Black Struggle. And we told them, these are going to be the recommendations. Now, y'all tell us which ones are important to you. And independently, that group began to work to make sure that our process and our policy was met with this last element, I really am done, which is power. And as much as we talk about these realities and the creation of a policy agenda, what was going to make it happen was accountability for people like this guy, Chris Koster, the attorney general at the time, who wanted to be the governor, who told us that he would be at the accountability meeting. When we delivered the report to the governor, the organizers gave me the license when we delivered the report to use that time when CNN and MSNBC came back to pay attention to us to say, here, governor, here's the report. Here, community, here's the report. And by the way, on November 1st, if you would gather in this room at St. Louis University, we're going to have a public accountability meeting. And we're going to ask the executives in this state, the elected officials in this community, which one of these policy recommendations they're going to make happen. And that guy who was running at the time, who was the attorney general, said that he was going to come to that meeting on that Sunday afternoon. And on Friday, he sent a note that said that he wasn't going to come. That did not make those organizers very happy. Our process was solid. Our policies were on point. Maybe there were too many of them, but they were on point. Maybe there was a little too much trauma-informed covering, but they were on point. But they lacked power to get anything done until those organizers said, this is the part of the policy agenda that matters for us, and said, we're going to put 1,100 people in a room, and they're going to ask these leaders what they're going to do about it. And when that brother decided that he wasn't going to show up for them with 48 hours notice and made them feel like after sitting with them eye to eye around a table that he had lied to them, they said, oh, it ain't going to go down like that. So started a Twitter storm on him on Friday. He still didn't show up on Sunday. And Sunday put out an empty chair for him. They found out that it was the mayor who told the attorney general who's running for governor not to come to the meeting. So on Monday morning after Sunday afternoon, there was an occupation of the mayor's office. We'll be here until you give us a date that you and the attorney general can make it. And so we left with a date. 3 weeks later, they both showed up. So they put 800 people in another room. Gave them another opportunity. I say all this to say, as I'm really done, I'm a Baptist preacher, so I can stop three times, but I'm just gonna stop one time. Because I'm not preaching, I'm lecturing. My feet are in the same place. That our policy agendas, when we give them to the people, when we engage in a process that's really about healing, when we understand that it's politicized by their realities and that must have cultural marks and elements of the same creative marks of poetry that we had to bring in when we brought young people into the commission process, we also have to recognize that at some point our policies mean nothing but paper unless they're given to people with power, and those people have to hold us and others accountable to making them happen. I know you asked me to come here to have a policy conversation, but I'd like to talk about power. Because power among people makes policy happen. And I'd like to introduce some of these people. So I don't go anywhere without introducing people to Kayla. Kayla Reed is the most powerful woman you have ever known. She's not yet crossed her 30th birthday. She has gathered with others to elect the first Black sheriff, the first Black county executive, the first Black county prosecutor, first Black city prosecutor, all committed to reform agendas by the people after sitting through rooms like this where they were asked, what in the Ferguson Commission report are you going to get done? And then being able to say and to know, look, you don't do it if you don't want to, but I can make sure that you're not here next time around. And so I celebrate with her and others who have made sure that the only county prosecutor that she has known all of her life in St. Louis County, she helped to get deposed in the elections on November 6th officially, and really the ones in August before that, because our policy is palpable when we give it to people with power. I'm really glad to be here and glad to share with you and hope to answer questions about what you really wanted me to talk about.
We hope you enjoyed listening to this podcast. For more information about Grantmakers in Health, visit us online at gih.org.